Parents, here's a gift idea that doesn't require batteries, screens, or endless assembly on Christmas morning. It's called the Dadventures Deck, a deck of silly adventures and unexpected twists for you and your kids. Pull one card and suddenly you're on a superhero bike ride or turning the backyard into a treasure island. My daughter still talks about the memories we've made from this deck. I've only got about 20 of these decks left, and once they're gone, they're gone. So if you want a simple way to spark memories with your kids this holiday season, go to ringspodcast.com/deck. Again, that's ringspodcast.com/deck. Start making more epic memories with your children today. In a smoky, dim-lit corner of the Prancing Pony, the fate of Middle-earth quietly shifts. In a dark corner sits a stranger who no one seems to know. Not the innkeeper, Barleyman, not Frodo, and not even J.R.R. Tolkien himself. Who is this man? Is his meeting with Frodo mere chance or something more? Today on Lore of the Rings, we continue our wandering into J.R.R. Tolkien's Fellowship of the Ring, Book 1, Chapter 9, At the Sign of the Prancing Pony. This is Part 2 of 3 examining this chapter. I'm Aaron, your host and guide to wandering Middle-earth. Visit ringspodcast.com to contact me, find previous episodes, or leave a review for the show. Now, let's wander. In the previous episode, we explored how Tolkien took us from the macro to the micro, from the crossroads to Bree to the Prancing Pony, to the common room of the Prancing Pony. The innkeeper, Barleyman Butterbur, invited the hobbits to the common room for, quote, a bit of news or any story or song that they would like to share. Let's take a moment and size up this common room. On the one hand, it's the quintessential meeting place tavern that one might expect from, say, a Dungeons & Dragons campaign. And honestly, I think D&D taverns and pubs are likely all modeled after this very common room. The first detail to note, this company in the room is mixed, contrary to Peter Jackson's films, which have only a grungy version of the Bree Big Folk. This common room is full of a variety of races and peoples. Another detail, as Tolkien points out, many of the Bree Folk have, quote, botanical names. But to the hobbits' reassurance, many of the Little Folk, or hobbits, of Bree have, quote, natural names. If you look closely at these allegedly natural names, you'll note that they are all formations of land by water or by hill. So it makes sense that Frodo's alias, Underhill, would fit in and have some connections with hobbits and Bree. The perspective of the scene shifts slightly as Frodo soon finds himself, quote, sitting alone in a corner, listening and looking around. From a narrative standpoint, we as readers get to examine this common room through Frodo's eyes. One thing he observes is that several strangers are fleeing from the south because, quote, there was trouble away in the south. But a clue that you're seeing this through a hobbit's eyes is the hobbit-like interpretation of the news, quote, the hobbits did not pay much attention to all this, and it did not at the moment seem to concern the hobbits. This statement does more than reinforce Frodo's perspective as narrator here. It is also a hint at a larger, major theme in The Lord of the Rings. The hobbits still consider themselves somewhat apart from the concerns of the wider world. They are content to ignore those problems. Frodo and his companions do not yet realize the critical role they will have in the destiny of Middle-earth. The troubles down south are not their concern, that's big folk problems, and big folk don't need hobbits trying to help them. At least, that is the base-level assumption of the big folk and the little folk. We will see this theme take full speed once we get to a few statements by Elrond in the chapter The Council of Elrond, but we're a few months away from that, so stick a pin in this theme for now. Back to the common room, Pippin has stolen the attention of most of the big folk, as he starts to deliver some of what Barleyman asked for. He's sharing news and stories from the Shire. But there's one big folk worth noting, quote, a strange-looking, weather-beaten man sitting in the shadows near the wall. Barleyman and Frodo have a whispered conversation about the man, in which Frodo learns that his name is Strider, and he is a ranger. I want to point out two things about Strider before we get to his conversation with Frodo. The first is the narrative importance of this scene. As I mentioned in the previous episode, the men of Bree are essentially tall hobbits. Look closely at this chapter, and you'll see how often the big folk are associated with laughter, merriment, joy, and warm welcoming, much like hobbits are. However, in the corner of the common room is a man who is taller, darker, and more grim than the men of Bree. He stands out in stark contrast. This is different than the portrayal in Peter Jackson's films. In those films, all the men of Bree are tall and dark and somewhat menacing to our provincial hobbits who had never left the Shire. From a cinematic perspective, that makes logical sense. Peter Jackson had to show how Bree was different than the Shire. But what gets lost in that adaptation is how different Strider really is from the men of Bree. He's a dark outsider who doesn't belong, from his dark hair and stern face, to his worn-down clothes, to his attitude, sitting ominously in the corner. Clearly, Tolkien meant for Strider to be different from the men of Bree. But that doesn't mean that Tolkien himself knew perfectly who Strider was, which brings me to my second observation. In the previous episode, I mentioned a letter in which Tolkien described the connection between the Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings, and you may be surprised about what he has to say about his own character Strider. Quote, "I met a lot of things on the way that astonished me. Strider, sitting in the corner at the inn, was a shock, and I had no more idea who he was than had Frodo." I really love this admission by Tolkien, as it shows his writing style. Tolkien may have some high-level outlines for the story that he may or may not follow, but his characters slowly manifested themselves to him as he wrote. Strider will actually get a whole chapter named for him, and we'll learn much more about this intriguing character. So for now, let's see what he has to say to Frodo in the common room of the Prancing Pony. But before we do that, please take a moment and tap the share button and send this episode link to a friend of yours. You can find the share link on the menu of the episode page on most podcast apps, or find it easily below the video if you're watching on YouTube. And if you are on YouTube, I welcome you to drop a comment down below. What do you think of this adaptation change of making Strider just like the Brelanders in the films? Was that a good or bad adaptation choice? I'd love to hear what you have to say. If you've only seen the films and this is your first time reading the books, then you may be surprised that Frodo and Strider actually have a conversation together in the common room. But Strider, in fact, waves Frodo over, and without any mention of hesitation, Frodo accepts the invitation. Strider says a few things here that indicate that he knows more about Frodo than he should. The repeated use of "if" is what gives this away. If Underhill is his real name, or if he was on a quest like Frodo, he would stop his friends from talking. Strider also comments on the Prancing Pony itself and reveals its primary narrative purpose. Quote, "Drink, fire, and chance meeting are pleasant enough. It's that idea of a chance meeting at Bree that catches my attention. It was in Bree where Gandalf and Thorin the Dwarf first happened to meet all those years ago. Remember that the theme of chance in The Lord of the Rings is not merely a lucky coincidence. Rather, chance seems to be more of a divine intervention for the good peoples of Middle-earth, an event so extremely unlikely and unlooked for that only some higher power could have orchestrated it." Strider redirects Frodo's attention back to Pippin, who at this point is sharing another story, Bilbo's disappearance from the long-expected party. Remember, it's been about 17 years between the party and when Frodo arrived at Bree, hence the comment, quote, "rumors long ago," but Frodo is concerned that the story will bring the name of Baggins into people's minds. Given all the attention on names and family connections that this chapter has already provided, it's no wonder that Frodo wants to direct attention away from Pippin's story. Strider again seemingly knows more than he should, as if he knew the story already and had some inside knowledge about the ring, and that Frodo is actually a Baggins. He convinces Frodo to, quote, "do something quick." So Frodo stands and starts to gain the attention of the common room crowd, and this decision may prove disastrous for him. Let's take a short break, and then we'll explore Frodo's latest temptation to use the One Ring. The countdown is on. Holiday shopping season is officially here. Uncommon Goods takes the stress out of gifting with thousands of unique, high-quality finds you won't see anywhere else. I discovered their literary clock, which tells time using quotes from classic books. Thousands of options, one for every minute. It's clever, personal, and perfect for the book lover in your life. And because my family always breaks out board games during the holidays, I ordered a wooden code breaker game and a murder mystery jigsaw puzzle. Can't wait to solve that one together. Uncommon Goods has something for everyone. When you shop, you're supporting small, independent artists and makers. And with every purchase, they donate $1 to a nonprofit partner. So don't wait. Cross those names off your list before the rush. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/LOTRpod. That's uncommongoods.com/LOTRPOD for 15% off. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary. Parents, here's a gift idea that doesn't require batteries, screens, or endless assembly on Christmas morning. It's called the Dadventures Deck, a deck of silly adventures and unexpected twists for you and your kids. Pull one card and suddenly you're on a superhero bike ride or turning the backyard into a treasure island. My daughter still talks about the memories we've made from this deck. I've only got about 20 of these decks left, and once they're gone, they're gone. So if you want a simple way to spark memories with your kids this holiday season, go to ringspodcast.com/deck. Again, that's ringspodcast.com/deck. Start making more epic memories with your children today. Frodo has redirected attention away from Pippin with the start of a little speech. As he does so, he falls on the old habit of playing with whatever is in his pocket, a very common response for anyone who suddenly finds themselves in a public speaking situation. Don't tell me that you've never done that before. But unlike most instances of public speaking, Frodo carries Sauron's One Ring in his pocket, and he experiences a great temptation. Quote, "He felt the ring on its chain, and quite unaccountably the desire came over him to slip it on and vanish out of the silly situation. It seemed to him somehow, as if the suggestion came to him from outside, from someone or something in the room." Let's examine this a little more closely. The ring clearly is exerting its will over Frodo. So far in this situation, Frodo had not been tempted to use the ring until he touched it. That indicates to me that the ring's power over Frodo is still rather minimal. It's almost like he's forgotten it's there, similar to Bilbo and Gollum during the riddle game in the dark. This is not the first time that Frodo has been tempted to use the ring, though. The first temptation was back in Chapter 1, after the long-expected party, when Frodo is meeting the Saxfield Bagginses. At that time he is, quote, "fidgeting with something in his pocket." You and I know that it is the ring. In both these situations, Frodo was exhausted and hoping to get out of an embarrassing situation. He didn't want to discuss Bilbo's will with the Saxfield Bagginses, neither does he want to give a speech at the Prancing Pony. But there's something else at work in this temptation at the inn. Spies of the enemy, in the form of the strangers from the south, are in attendance in Bree, and the ring is trying to return to its master. So let's take a look at another previous temptation. The encounter with the Black Rider on the road back in the chapter Three is Company. In that temptation, Frodo, quote, "felt that he had only to slip the ring on, and then he would be safe." In each of these temptations, Frodo is seeking comfort, physical or emotional safety, or at least to escape a bad situation. And that's much the same feeling that he has in the common room in Bree. In reviewing these temptations to use the ring, I'm reminded of what Tolkien wrote in the Waldman Letter in 1951 about power, quote, "making the will more quickly effective, and so to machine or magic. By the last I intend all the use of external plans or devices, instead of developments of the inherent inner powers or talents." So what does that mean? For Frodo, the ring is an external device that he is tempted to use in order to more quickly obtain his desires. He thinks the ring will help him disappear and avoid these uncomfortable situations. But here's the difficulty. While the ring indeed will make Frodo disappear from the seen world, it is still an external device, and not the use of his inherent natural talents. Hobbits, if you remember from the prologue, quote, "possessed from the first the art of disappearing swiftly and silently, when large folk whom they do not wish to meet come blundering by, and this art they have developed, until to men it may seem magical." Hence why Frodo's use of the ring to disappear is a temptation. To use such an external device is a deviation from his natural inherent powers, and that would only be the beginning of a slippery slope to eventual attempted domination. But we have also already seen another instance of temptation, in which Frodo actually did put on the ring, that we need to compare. While in the house of Tom Bombadil, in that case, Frodo felt compelled to check that the ring Tom had returned to him was indeed the One Ring. In his annoyance, Frodo puts on the ring, to find that his friends can't see him, but Tom Bombadil still can. Frodo laughs it off as a joke, quote, "trying to feel pleased," but I read that as a sort of guilty feeling on the part of Frodo. Back to Bree and the Prancing Pony, while Frodo again feels the outside pole to put on the ring, in this instance, he is able to resist and, quote, at any rate, it gave him no inspiration. It's as if the ring knows that servants of its master are near, and it wants to be revealed to them. And it's almost as if the ring knows that Frodo's speech is an attempt to veer attention away from other stories about the ring, hence why it gives no inspiration. Even though Frodo is able to resist the temptation, the ring is a devious device not to be underestimated, and Frodo's chance meeting may turn out to be rather unlucky. But we'll get to that next time. Thank you to this episode's executive producer, The Old One. If you would like to support the show, visit ringspodcast.com/member. Thank you for wandering Middle Earth with me today. Parents, here's a gift idea that doesn't require batteries, screens, or endless assembly on Christmas morning. It's called the Dadventures Deck, a deck of silly adventures and unexpected twists for you and your kids. Pull one card and suddenly you're on a superhero bike ride or turning the backyard into a treasure island. My daughter still talks about the memories we've made from this deck. I've only got about 20 of these decks left, and once they're gone, they're gone. So if you want a simple way to spark memories with your kids this holiday season, go to ringspodcast.com/deck. Again, that's ringspodcast.com/deck. Start making more epic memories with your children today.